Welcome, friends. Thank you for joining me. My name is Leon Pittard. I'm the host of Fair Dinkum Radio, broadcasting from the land down under in Australia. Well, we are talking about government. Worldwide, the population of the earth are agitated and in turmoil. Most populations are unhappy with the way government is moving ever closer into their personal lives. It does not matter where you look. Government and the actions of government against its people is the cause of financial hardship, sickness, and often death. The question is, what is government? Is it an illusion? Can we withdraw support of government and live a contented, peaceful life without government intrusion in our lives? Or do we need government to tell us, to govern us? Do we need to remain children under the constant guidance of government, telling us what to think, say, eat, and then threatening us if we choose to think, speak, or act in a manner contrary to their dictates? Well, joining us to talk about these things is our friend James Corbett of the Corbett Report to speak about this very important subject. James, welcome to Fair Dinkum Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Leon. It's always a pleasure talking to you, so thanks again for having me here.
Well, you are welcome, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time, and as I've been listening to this conversation worldwide with different people, including yourself, it is a subject of great interest to everyone that is of a thinking mind and really concerned about their future.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it comes down to the most fundamental aspects of our society and how it's organized and how it should be organized. And that affects everything that we do and everything that we transact in the marketplace and everything that we think privately in our own homes. It touches on every aspect of our lives. So there's really nothing more fundamental that we could be talking about than this type of question about how society is organized and how it should be organized. And where do we go from here to reach the type of society that we want? And that's a pretty tall order for a conversation, but let's roll up our sleeves and do our best.
Exactly. And I've often wondered how much percentage of the airways and media would contain the word government. I mean, how much of our content is talking about government in whatever field of media you are in. And it seems to me that no one is happy with government worldwide. And James, I mean, you are more of a geopolitical watcher than what I am, but is there anywhere in the world where peoples of a nation are happy and content with the government that is ruling over them?
Yeah, I would be hard-pressed to think of one. I think you could find more or less levels of satisfaction with government, but I don't think there's anywhere where people would say they were perfectly happy and couldn't imagine a better society. And at the end of the day, I think that should be what it's the rubric that we're holding this up to anyway. It shouldn't necessarily be about whether people are content enough. It should be about, well, how can we improve on what we are doing already? And when it's framed in that manner, I don't think anyone can or should be averse to that type of conversation.
Yes, and it leads me to think, I was hoping you were going to say yes, and I wanted to know where it was so that I might be able to at least holiday there and experience what this nation and people's environment was like. But since it's no, I guess it leads me to think, is this a structural issue of government, as there are many different forms of government that exist, that has brought us to where we are in time? Or is it not structure, but is it people, or is it a combination of both?
I would argue that in some ways this is almost an ontological question that goes right to the heart of what exists in our world and why it exists and how we interact with that. And to a certain extent, this is going to be a theoretical conversation because we can only guess at structures and forms of society that don't exist in our planet. But at any rate, I think that there's something more fundamental than just the way that our government is structured. And if we could just tweak those settings, then we could finally arrive at a perfectly peaceful and happy society. I mean, that would be a utopian strain of thinking that I think has, it's quite easy to say from history, there's never been that type of society on the planet yet. And no reason to think that there's any magic settings that we can, just switch the dial to that would make everyone happy. And unfortunately, the main thrust of history has proven time and again that that type of utopian thinking leads to the worst kind of atrocities, because people who are killing in the name of creating a perfect society are in some ways the most ruthless killers, because they believe they have some right idea on their side. So I think we have to be wary of that type of utopian thinking, that we're ever going to come at ultimate happiness. And besides, I think that that is coming from the wrong perspective. That's coming from a utilitarian perspective, where we measure the value of a society by simply the amount of happiness that it produces, as if human beings are really just happiness machines, and that's the only way you can measure the fulfillment of someone's life. I think obviously humanity is much more complex than that, and I think we can't just look at that as the sole deciding factor of whether a society is functioning properly or not, or even if there is such a thing as a properly quote-unquote functioning society. So there's a lot to bite off and chew there, philosophically speaking, but I guess I would say that that I certainly don't think it's a structural issue just with regards to the way that the government is functioning. I think it has to be more fundamental than that. It has to be about the nature of government itself and the way that intercedes in our natural interactions with other human beings.
Well, let's take a look at what we've inherited and whether or not we have come to this point in time for whatever reason. But we have inherited, James, your home country, Canada, and us here in Australia, this idea of representative government. And we've been told from our parents from birth, we've been taught this in our educational systems and the media and the whole environment around us, that these members of parliament are there to represent us to the collective oligarchy, and that they are there to carry out the people's will. I mean, in the history of representative government, there must have been times when this did happen. But, I mean, we've come to a time when clearly this is not happening today under the system of governance that in Canada and Australia, and, well, I would go as far as to say almost everywhere in the world, that these members of parliament who are supposed to represent the people do not represent the will of the people at all.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the obvious extrapolations that we can make from that observation, that so many people are unhappy with the governments that claim to represent them. And I think we have to go from that point to really question that fundamental assumption that there is some sort of representation that's taking place here. And I don't think you'd have to argue too vociferously with the most Australians or Americans, Canadians, Japanese, people in the sort of modern industrialized representative democracies that this system is functioning for the benefit of the special interests. There are very few people who would overlook that aspect of what's happening today. And again, I think that goes to really the fundamental issues of what we're dealing with, because as long as we can be convinced that what we are dealing with is a system that more or less functions towards representing us in this system to the lawmakers, etc. As long as we're in that nexus, then to a certain extent, it's a rigged game that we lose no matter how we play. We might lose a little bit less if we choose the right representative who has the right connections and makes the right decisions. But still, fundamentally, we are giving away our political power and our responsibilities to people who are going off to some far distant city, usually some capital city, to so-called represent us in the hallowed halls of governmental power. And once we buy into that system in any form or accept that, then in a key sense, we've already bought into the game. And that represents, I think, the point at which we have completely abrogated our political responsibilities. I think if you look 100 years ago at the mentality of the average person in, for example, in Australia, in America, in other places around the world, there would have been a more of a sense that for example, social ills and social responsibility was something that was incumbent on individuals to find ways to help ameliorate. And there would have been more of a sense of individuals helping out in their community, etc., and directly helping helping with people in times of need. And there was a lot of different social institutions that were constructed around that and that fed into that, religious institutions and others that played into that. But in the creation of the Great Society that obviously took off in the United States in earnest in the 1930s with FDR and all of those changes and the social safety net and all of these other things that we're supposed to applaud as great advances, has come exactly attendant with that, the complete abrogation of that responsibility, that's to the point where most people think that their responsibility to other people and their contribution to helping other people in their times of need is choosing the right political candidate to represent the right set of political ideals, to implement the right policies and to pass the right laws in order for the government to then provide the right framework for those citizens, whether that be from a quote-unquote right perspective of lower taxes generating economic activity, which creates the better, you know, economic situation for people, or from the left perspective of bigger government, bigger safety net will mean that fewer people will end up on the streets or whatever it is. It deflects our responsibility as human beings in our community to the extent that people think that pulling a lever in a voting booth is the extent of what they have to do every 4 years in order to actually do something of value in their community.
Well, for those of our listeners who may be in some doubt about this issue, I'd just like to play here a short clip regarding Senator Roy Blunt and his connections to the corporate world and indeed how government works in this system that we are talking about.
Last week, a very disturbing provision was slipped into the latest Senate budget bill. This small and conspicuous provision was coined the Monsanto Protection Act. Essentially, it deregulated genetically modified foods even more, further solidifying Monsanto's power over the food supply and their total immunity from prosecution. They wrote the provision. Until now. Apparently, Senator Roy Blunt is a proud lackey for big ag business. You see, he just boasted to Politico that he was the one who wrote this additional piece of legislation. And one just has to look at he and his family's incestual relationship with Monsanto to understand why. Public records show Monsanto has been backing Mr. Blunt's congressional career since 2008. He's taken in well over $100,000 in campaign contributions from the corporation over the last 5 years. But that's not all. During his 2010 Senate run alone, he took in over $243,000 from ag business across the board. Yep, this guy might be the most GMO-friendly politician on the Hill, but this dirty political scheming is nothing new for Mr. Blunt. Back in 2002, while serving in the House, he tried to sneak in a provision into a Homeland Security bill in the same way he did with the Monsanto Protection Act. Only then, it was a measure that would benefit the tobacco giant Philip Morris. So what's Blunt's interest with big tobacco? Well, his wife, Abigail Blunt, was a lobbyist for Philip Morris at the time. And it seems like his wife is still strong-arming the senator because she's since moved on to head the government relations for Kraft Foods, one of the biggest processed food corporations in the country. You know, the same Kraft Foods that shelled out $2 million against Prop 37's GMO labeling effort in California. But wait, there's more. This man's entire family is one living conflict of interest. Blunt's son, a lobbyist for the auto industry, was honored by Monsanto for his excellent...
James, as the RT reporter there very rightly labelled, the fact that there is this incestual relationship between those that are there to represent the people, but in effect they are really representing major corporations worldwide, which have really co-opted government worldwide to run over the rights and the wills of the people.
There's no question about that, and probably Monsanto is the premier case in point of this in the halls of the American government, and people can see there's a lot of infographics online out there that portray some of the revolving door of Monsanto and government regulatory positions, so that you have people like Michael Taylor, who was the former vice president at Monsanto, who is now the Obama's food safety czar. You have Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court justice, who worked as a Monsanto attorney for 4 years. You have people like David Beyer. He was the head of government affairs for Genentech, which was swallowed up by Monsanto and became the chief domestic policy advisor to Vice President Gore. You have people like William Conlon and Sam Skinner, who worked on Monsanto's legal team. Now they're in the Department of Justice. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. The list is actually quite ridiculous when you start taking a look at it in detail. And unfortunately, that isn't the only example. I mean, you could look, for example, at Goldman Sachs, which is sometimes referred to as government Sachs because of the exact same situation where a lot of the so-called banking regulators and people in the Treasury Department, et cetera, tend to come from Goldman Sachs. And that's not just an American phenomenon. That's happened all around the world, as we saw, for example, in the EU, where you have the head of the ECB and you have people like Mario Draghi and others who are being parachuted into places like Italy that have no real credentials other than the fact that they're Goldman Sachs operatives, basically. And again, this happens time and time again in so many different positions that it really does take a type of doublethink to deny the reality that this is the way that politics functions. But even if we do understand that this is unfortunately where we've arrived at this corporate government fascistic model that has taken over, there are still people, I think, who want to believe that this is just a contingent factor, that this isn't something that's a necessary part of the way government is structured. And my argument would be that this is exactly what this form of representative democracy has always been intended to be. It's been always, I think, aimed at getting people to acquiesce to the idea that this government has the moral authority to be making these types of decisions for the people. And from there, it's only a short step and hop and a jump towards setting up the regulatory infrastructure, which can then be wielded as the big stick of the big corporations. And I think this is, again, this is not contingent. This is sort of the necessary way that these systems have evolved. And at any rate, as I say, it would be hard pressed to find any government anywhere in the world, any so-called representative democracy that hasn't evolved to a similar situation. There might be more or less degrees of this type of cronyism taking place, but I think we can all, no matter where you might be in the world right now listening to this, I'm sure we can all agree that this happens. So again, I think we have to interrogate this at a much more fundamental level to look at solutions to what we see taking place, because it can't just be a question of getting more, giving the regulators more power to regulate the corporations, which themselves are feeding into the regulatory bodies, because that is the vicious circle. And again, if we play that game, it is a game that we are designed to lose each and every time. So we have to think of this from a completely different perspective and really start to question the fundamental assumptions of who is in power over the society and whom it gets to make the laws.
Absolutely. And I'd like to look at a couple of common myths about government. And just before we get off democracy, I notice that you did allude to the fact there that, and Aldous Huxley pointedly said in one of his speeches that it was better to gain the consent of the people in order to have them ruled, rather than by the rulership of a gun, that they would always be ruled better if they could be psychologically or scientifically made to actually consent to the system. And which leads me to think about that most people think that a democracy is a system of government where they have a say in the direction and the future of their country and the environment around them. And yet here in Australia, for instance, if I could just use this example, we have a mandatory voting law which says that you must consent. In other words, that you must participate in this systemic voting process, even if you do not agree with government. And that fundamental point is what people think democracy is, that they get to have a vote once every three in the federal level or 4 years in the state level. But it is what happens in between the voting that I have learnt, and many people are becoming awake to, is that the voting is really not the issue. It's what happens every day in the continuance program of incorporating economic interests in monopoly situations over our lives.
Well, just as in any other aspect of our lives, I mean, the devil is in the details, and the details are the actual day-to-day functioning of the government. And it's interesting how we have been placed into that observer role, that we're just spectators in this sport of politics, and we can choose which team we want to root for, but we can't choose the plays that the teams are making on the field. That's still up to the coaches, who we have this illusion that we can put the right coach into place, and he'll come out with the right game plan to get us to the right place. But it's also so detached from the reality of the day-to-day functioning of the government that it is amazing that people think they have any control over this system. And it is kind of a marvel of social engineering to have arrived at this place where so many people will not just defend the system the way it is, they will vigorously defend it as if they are defending a key part of their own identity. And I think that's the insidious aspect that Aldous Huxley was pointing out there. And obviously, the sort of literary paradigm that presents itself is the battle between the 1984 society and the Brave New World society, where you have the choice between the boot in the face basically being that overt tyranny that keeps people down through outright brute force, versus the Aldous Huxley Brave New World model, where it's all done through people's willingness to go along with a system that keeps them happy and sedate in various ways, whether that be through the somatic stupor that the modern drugs of choice can provide people, or the type of promiscuous sex society that keeps people in that state of just bodily happiness that people mistake for satisfaction. And this functions at a much more insidious psychological level, because if people are happy with their state of affairs, it won't even occur to them to try to change them. And I think we can see that in the type of religion that's been constructed around the democratic ideal, so-called. And of course, we can look at people like Chomsky for all of his shortcomings. He certainly has done some pioneering work in pointing out how people like Walter Lippmann and others really did consciously and quite in black and white write about this type of thing, their idea that democracy has to be about the process of manufacturing consent, which is, I mean, a tyranny by any other name, but because people are willingly going along with that tyranny, I mean, it presents that type of philosophical puzzle, I suppose. Just as you can't rape the willing, I suppose you can't be tyrants of people who are willingly subjected to your tyranny. And that's, I mean, that's the type of paradox that we're living in, that so many people actually seem to desire the state of affairs that they understand in every other way that it's presented to them is a state of tyranny.
Absolutely. And it's interesting at this time which we live, where I see both arms of that system are actually working at the moment, as in the 1984 way of force and brute suppression, ordered, structured society, and drones watching us through our windows, a surveillance system, etc., and the Aldous Huxley psychological, scientific, pharmaceutical influences. It's almost like both are in play at the moment to bring about the desired goals, depending on whether we are more intellectual thinking or feeling type people, more or less, as you mentioned there. But James, I know that very soon you are to become a father, and we wish you well and your wife into the future. And I want to talk about a little bit about inheritance, something that is important to you. You're very soon to have a child, and how we inherit from our parents a lot of our parents' thoughts about government and the things that we're taught about. And if I go back in history, even to biblical times, the people said, you know, we want a king. God said, no, you don't want a king. If you get a king, he's going to tax you and you're going to be his slaves. Nevertheless, they said, we want a king. So he gave them a king, and exactly what he said happened. They ended up taxed. They ended up going into slavery. Now, we've been taught in our generation, and I think from our parents also, that we must have government to rule over us, to make decisions for us. Now, if we look at the family, I've had children, and my girls now are past the age of the appointed time, I call it. You know, we look after the children, we take responsibility for them as parents, and until the time when they mature and are able to make their own conscious decisions. And then, in the biblical sense, they're said they're set free. But in society, it seems that we have adopted this idea that we never grow up and take responsibility for our own actions, and that government must delegate responsibility to us through this collective mindset concept.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's an important thing to stress. It's often said, for example, that a fish would have no concept of water because it's just that all-pervasive environment in which they're born and live and die in. And so they have no idea of the not water to contrast it to. And in the same way, I think that children who are born into our current society have no real understanding of statism, because statism is what we are steeped in from the moment of our birth, and it's just the paradigm in which we're living. To the idea that there could be anything but statism is kind of a strange thing to imagine, and that's why even that word statism is probably, you know, new to a lot of people. Every time I say that word, I think I get some puzzled reactions from people who don't quite understand what that even means. And so I think absolutely the most important thing that a parent can do, and something that I think is absolutely the most important responsibility that I will have in raising my child, is to not just present conclusions to children. I think that that obviously does the disservice of putting them in that position where later in life, when they are presented with conclusions from authority figures, they would be more inclined to simply accept them because that's all they've been used to. I think the most important thing that we can do is to try to teach the children the reasoning processes by which we can arrive at conclusions with some degree of certainty. And that is the process that I think has been self-evidently excluded from our so-called education system over the past several generations, and consciously so, because obviously it is much easier to rule over a population that has been deprived of that ability to arrive at conclusions, and just to short-circuit that process by feeding children with preformed conclusions. So I think it has to be a process of teaching children how to learn about the world around them, and that might sound cliched, but I think, again, it really does come down to that, because if we can raise a generation of children who are not simply going to accept whatever is told to them, but actively inquire into how that information was arrived at, we will necessarily have a more free society, or whatever a paradigm you want to frame that in, the type of society that I think we are all looking for, where people are not simply going to be cogs in a machine to be slotted into a system, but they are going to be active participants in creating the world around them. And what better service can you do to a child than to give them the tools to actually do and construct that type of world?
It's interesting that whenever you speak to, whenever I speak to anyone about this subject, about the possibility of living in a world without government structure as we know it today, almost the first thing that always comes to their minds, or if you say you're going to withdraw support to the government, now, one of the first things that comes to mind that they always bring up is, well, who's going to build the roads? Or who is going to look after us? Who's going to protect us? And I think that, as you mentioned earlier, this is because we have ceded our individual responsibility as a people to a system that says, well, they will look after it. We have abrogated our own responsibility in caring for each other, and we've given it to government and said, well, that's their job to protect, for instance, to look after my neighbour, or to, you know, look after my fellow man in some way, or to provide for the hungry. You know, these things are things that, instead of individuals taking responsibility for, we've abrogated that in the system and the society we've been born in, and we've allowed government to take more and more control over individual responsibility. Where in Australia, this in the last 3 years, we've had over 7,500 new laws that have come into place just to help control society.
Well, that's such an important point, and I think that one of the underlying points of why that pre-programmed response has been pre-programmed, and why it continues to flourish in the minds of people when they are confronted with the idea of someone being against the forms of government that we've been presented with, I think part of that is simply to do with the tyranny of the definition of the words that are being used, and how the connotations of words can be used to try to dissuade people from looking into certain subjects as well. And perhaps my bias as an ex-English major is showing, but I really do think that the language and the way that it's yielded and wielded really does have such a an incredible amount of control over people's responses. So I think it's not, it can't be simply just a happenstance that the word, for example, the word anarchy, which is one way of expressing a type of opposition to forms of governmental control, has been so maligned and so misused and so misapplied and so equated with random acts of bomb throwing and chaos and all the other negative implications of what people associate with that word, that it has ceased to be useful any longer as a way of describing a type of political ideology, because there's just so much emotional and mental baggage that come along with that. And it, as you say, brings with it all of these pre-programmed responses. Anarchy, well, what are you talking about? How would we build the roads, etc.? Because again, I think the fundamental terms have been predefined in people's heads in ways that are different than the people who have stepped outside of that system would see. So that even the definition of government itself, which obviously must be the key concept that we have to have the firmest grip on if we want to even broach the subject of what government is, how it functions, and how we can actually function as a society without that, that has even been elided to the point where people think of government as any type of organization that provides any type of service like what we understand government to provide, the social safety net or the military or whatever it is that people think it is that is fundamental to what government does. Whereas I think people who are coming at it from a different perspective would see that government, more properly defined, would refer to the implied right, the implied authority to be the sole governing principle, the sole way of organizing those types of responses and those types of institutions in our society, and the implied monopoly of violence and power that comes along with that. And if we're trying to argue against the monopoly of violence and power, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're arguing against forms of organization in society. It doesn't mean that people couldn't come together voluntarily to do the exact same types of things that government is doing. Maybe they would choose to do something completely different. Maybe they would choose to do something that's substantially similar to what's being done right now. But the key part of that, the implied right to the monopoly of violence and power and an arbitrary authority that comes packaged up with that concept of government, is never scrutinized because the definition of that word is so much elided over in the whole discussion.
Absolutely. And if I could just use a simple example, if you did want to send your children to school, I actually homeschooled, my wife and myself homeschooled our children, but let's say you have a local school like we do in our little small area here that has, you know, probably 20 or 30 pupils. Why couldn't the community, for example, the community would come together and actually cooperate together to keep that school in a functioning capacity, whether it be helping with the actual instruction, teaching pupils to be learners and teachers themselves, or the maintenance, etc. Every aspect of that little school could be catered to by the community if we did take individual responsibility and join together to actually carry out that responsibility, in this case, in the example of a small school. This is a workable situation if the people would take the responsibility. But as we've stated, the mindset is more a deference to a higher power. We just want to get on our lives and do other things.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't see that my opposition to the government as we understand it today is a rejection of the idea of community or associating with other people. Of course not. And for example, decisions that myself and my wife are going to make about the education of our child are going to necessarily depend on the type of community that would be available to support that education, whatever form that would take. So that even if homeschooling would be the most preferable option in terms of giving us the most control over what the way that curriculum, so quote unquote, is shaped and the types of things that would be indoctrinated or not indoctrinated into our child. Still, I think that depends on such things as the type of community that would be there around to support those ideas and whether there would be support from other people around that are doing similar things, etc. Those would be the types of inputs that would make a difference. So again, I don't think that this idea of rejection of governmental system necessarily means that we all have to be atomized individuals living in in a sea of bubbles that don't interact with each other at all. Of course not. I think there is value to organization and to people coming together to try to find ways of pooling their energy, their resources, their ideas, of interacting with other people and of forming communities that do provide actual support to people. So again, I think that there's that type of false paradigm that people are being asked to choose on from, which is either you are for government or you are for, you know, living like an animal out in the wild trying to kill anyone who comes near you. And obviously that is not the case. But again, that's the type of image that people have in their mind and might be one of those ghosts that they're fighting if they ever even encounter the idea of someone who is not a statist.
Absolutely. Well, before we get off, one more common myth that I'd like to just touch on before we move on to some other weightier issues. But if we think about most societies, they have this, and especially ours, we have this constitution behind us, Bill of Rights in the United States. And many people, even today, are still hanging on to these documents and basically saying that if only we could have these things enforced or respected, we would have freedom. And I'm mindful of Club of Rome said, I think, in 1975 that democracy has failed and new forms of government are required. And so, you know, since then, of course, the government by corporation has increased to the point where we see a corporate force, monopoly, registration, allocation of resources, every different aspect of our life is we are being funneled into a situation where our autonomy is actually being removed. And I think the people, a lot of people that are hanging on to the idea that the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, and, you know, I often have people ring my talkback program and say, well, we just want the good old days back. And, James, in my thinking, those good old days, did they ever exist for a start? What is this that they are speaking about, the people? Do you think, is this just a time they were speaking about when there was less government control, but now it's just become such that people don't like to look at the future the way it's going?
I think there's a lot in there that kind of melds together. And I think that part of that certainly is that if you went back a couple of hundred years, I mean, there wouldn't have been the technology and just the ability for a federal government to control a nation as sprawling as Australia, as America, as some of these nations that exist today. That to have that type of control that they do in this day and age with departments of Homeland Security and all of this other, you know, mechanized type of tyranny that's come in. So I think people might in some ways be thinking, questing, dreaming of some sort of primitivist society where back in the day you could be far enough away from that center of power that it wouldn't necessarily directly affect your life, or at least not every aspect of your life in the way that it does today, where all decisions can at least theoretically be made in some centralized decision body and be spread to the four corners of the governmental structure very quickly. So I think to a certain extent people are looking back towards that. But on the issue of the documents that the Constitution, for example, in the United States that people so often enshrine, I think once we start to peel away the layers of that myth, people would have to admit that, no, it's not the document itself. It's not the piece of paper. It's not necessarily even those particular words in that particular order. It's the ideas that these documents are enshrining. And this gets into one of, I think, the fundamental pieces of the puzzle, which I think goes a long way towards explaining people's absolute inability almost to contemplate life without political power, is that political power really does represent that ring of Mordor. It is that golden ring that people become so enthralled with that if only they can possess that ring and they can be the ones to wield that power, then think of all the good they could do with that. And again, I think that's the utopian thinking that leads to the worst types of tyranny. And we all know how that plays out in the Lord of the Ring mythology. And I think, people have to understand that Tolkien himself was anarchistic in his political beliefs. He did not believe in government. He believed that government power was that type of ring that people quest for. And in the same way, if we are questing for, oh, if only we can get the Constitution with this, you know, this Bill of Rights, these amendments, then we can enshrine in some sort of document form the natural laws that we all adhere to and understand and apprehend as the right framework for any type of ethical system. So we can make that actually happen with these documents, and we can instantiate that in the world. But again, once you create the basis for that, where these documents can then become that conduit for law to be applied, then of course, what is the natural corollary of that? It's, well, the creation of more documents can create more laws. And that is the thin edge of the wedge through which all of the other tyranny can come in. So even if you were just simply to put down the most simple precepts of morality and ethical functioning for what we would, what type of system might govern a society, it would still allow the possibility, just by the very existence, the nature of those documents themselves, for other documents and other ideologies and other people to come along with other ideas for laws that would then be binding on a society in the same way that those original founding documents are. So I see it as that ring of power that we have to reject in order to come to that understanding, to in order to create the system that doesn't have to do with enforcing some sort of imaginary authority that that the documents themselves bring with them, because that is the system through which the tyranny actually functions. Without that ring of power, the tyranny can't come in that door, because that door is basically not open.
Well, let's follow on to the thought about government by force, and I'd just like to play this short clip by Larkin Rose in regard to this point.
And this gang of a few hundred said to the throng of 100 million, from now on, you all have to give us a cut of everything you earn.
This is an accurate graphical comparison between the number of American taxpayers and the number of U.S. congressmen.
And the throng said, gosh, do we have to give you a cut of what we earn? And the gang of a few hundred said, yes, you have to. And the throng said, well, okay, I guess we have to. And one little troublemaker asked, what if we don't? The gang of a few hundred didn't like this and said, if you do not comply, we shall unleash upon you our legions of enforcers. And the throng cried, oh no, please don't. We will comply. We will pay.
This is an accurate graphical comparison between the number of American taxpayers and the total number of IRS employees.
Time went by, and the gang of a few hundred said, now we want more of what you earn. And this kept happening over and over again, until eventually some of the throng were paying almost half of what they earned to the gang. Whenever the gang demanded more, the throng would say, golly, we're already having a tough time. Do we really need to give you even more? And the gang always said, yes, you must, or we shall unleash our legion of enforcers. Now the gang of a few hundred was getting trillions of dollars every year.
So we get the idea, James. If the people thought they had a choice, would people support corrupt government? That's the question. I mean, and we're getting start to, as we move into solutions, I mean, if we said, look, we do have a choice, would we be spending our energy, and as that short clip said, over 50% of our energy is spent supporting corrupt groups of people, killing people worldwide and in our own communities through all these different covert methods. The question is, if the people thought they had a choice, would they support corrupt government?
I think the obvious answer to that is no, and I think that can be easily enough demonstrated with pretty much anyone that you encounter, because there will be people out there who do support the entire mythical war on terror paradigm and the types of ridiculous, I guess ridiculous isn't even the right word, I guess morally repugnant wars that are waged in the name of this mythos. There are people who will support that and say, well, I'm happy that my tax dollars are going towards, you know, bringing the fight to the terrorists or whatever they buy into, but they will probably be the type who will be quite take umbrage at the fact that their tax dollars are going to pay useless hippies for lying around being unemployed bums or whatever it is that feeds into their political ideology. And on the flip side of that equation, there will be people who will be happy to pay into a system that they think is providing that social safety net, but will be repulsed by the idea that those tax dollars are going for example, to funding those wars. And on that point, every single person has that point at which they think it is it's something that goes against my very nature that I'm being forced to pay dollars into a system that I think is actually doing harm, but it's doing some good. There are some things about this that I enjoy and that I would voluntarily give my money up for. So I guess it's just one of those things, and we can jockey for the position of who has the control over that switch to direct more of the funds into the things that I want. And that's just the way society functions. And again, I think this actually comes back to that idea of community that I was talking about before. And I think it's the difference between community as an idea that brings with it an obligation versus community that brings with it a sense of responsibility. If someone has a sense of a basic moral sense of responsibility to fellow human beings, who just doesn't want to see fellow human beings suffering, from that people can devise systems for example, providing care for those in times of need, etc. Or we could imagine if there was some sort of collective outside force that was threatening our community, we could band together to try to fight off that force in our natural right to self-defense, etc. So people could understand how that could function. But when it becomes a sense of obligation, you are part of this community, therefore you must do X, Y, and Z, then once we accept that and internalize that, then we can be steeped into a structure which can then be wielded at the top by the very few as this big stick that, yes, we'll give you some of the things you want. If you want, for example, the social safety net, yeah, we'll give you a few bones there. But with that comes, well, we have to then, you have to agree to give us some of your money in order to do the things you don't want. And there are, every single person has some sort of moral, ethical, and even just philosophical reservation about that very concept. And when it's put to them in a black and white manner like that, rather than without all the jingoistic rhetoric and the patriotic rhetoric and all of the other things that they use to dress up these ideas, once it's put in those terms, do you think you should have a choice where your money is directed? And do you think that people should be given a choice as to what types of structures they'll build up in order to provide the best type of society? Once it's stripped of all the emotional baggage that comes with that, I think a lot more people would find that they are in tune with that philosophy, that idea that they should not be forced to pay their money, for example, to fund bombs in order to bomb brown people on the other side of the earth in order to make money for the very few at the very top, and all the political control and everything that comes with that. So again, I think it, once we get down to the individual level and talk to people on an individual level about the issues that correspond with their beliefs, I think they'll be able to see this in a much more apparent manner. And that's exactly why that type of conversation is so much anathema to the power structure that exists, and why it is so much discouraged for us to ever question that fundamental assumption. We can bicker over levels of taxation and what taxation could be used for, but the idea of taxation, how could you possibly question that? It's your civic duty. It's your obligation.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, I think, the core issue of this discussion is that government by force is fundamentally the opposition to government by freedom. For instance, voluntary government or voluntary association of people into communities, individuals banding together with other individuals, neighbours, communities, actively taking a part in their society's development and outcome. I mean, we see that the force is used in many different ways. In Australia here, we have a real push for mandatory vaccinations, and parents are facing, quote, barriers to enrolling them in school, like as if that's going to be a bad thing, you know. But that's what they're doing, setting up barriers so that they can't enrol them in school or childcare centres unless they are vaccinated. And get this, quote, immunisation experts have blamed the baby Einstein demographic, parents who take an avid interest in their children's development, who eat organic food and use alternative therapies, are the problem.
It doesn't get more blatant than that, does it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've called for sanctions against parents who actually share information about, you know, anti-vaccination, the anti-vaccination lobby. But notice the quotation here, like, parents who take an avid interest in their child's development, who eat organic and use alternative therapies, are the problem. So, James, you can see this force coming through, like even in words like that, the media, sanctions, barriers to this group that dares to take an interest in their children's development. We, the government, we will force you via this means.
And again, I think we can see this coming from both sides of the issue. Not only is it government decrees about what parents should be doing, but there's also that societal pressure that comes from just the societal milieu that's steeped in that type of propaganda that comes from the government. So that there's a lot of social exclusion, et cetera, that happens if people see you in that perspective. Oh, this is a crazy person who takes too much of an interest in their child's development. Oh, I better avoid them. And I think we can all relate to that. We all know people probably in our personal lives who think that any mention of alternative medicine or eating healthy, et cetera, is some sort of crazy conspiratorial thinking and might be putting your children in danger. So I think we see it from both sides of that equation. And that's why I think such a fundamental part of this conversation has to be directed towards how can we change the societal perception of these issues rather than how can we wield the big stick of government to allow people to have an interest in their child's development, for example.
Well, for those who may be not quite in the same understanding of what we are on these issues, I'd just like to play a short clip from Melissa Harris-Penny of MSNBC regarding the children and who really should take responsibility for their care.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
So there's an example of the social mindset steering people into thinking that children are really that the decisions for the children should come from the collective of society rather than from the parents, Jane.
Exactly right. I mean, that's chilling. And I hope that people out there understand why that type of talk is chilling. But I think what's most insidious about it is that we probably agree on 90% of the basic precepts of what's being said, that children are the future of our communities and that they will be the people who will decide what character and form those communities take on so that their development and upbringing really is something that affects the community as a whole. And I think no one would really disagree with that. And that's why it's so important for children to be nurtured and to have a proper environment for developing in. But then for that to be the question of ownership or control, that the way that she frames it there, and to say that, well, communities must get rid of this notion that families own their children, is that should be chilling for a lot of reasons, because that starts to take it into a completely different direction. The idea that education is important for children and that that will affect society in the future is uncontroversial, but the idea that that must be instituted through investment in public education, i.e. government-controlled education that dictates to parents what children must learn and how they must learn it, is a vast leap, and one that, again, once the more layers of that mystique that we can peel off of that, the fewer people would actually go along with it. But it can be couched in that rhetoric that sounds so good and that we've been indoctrinated and steeped in for so long, the it takes a village mentality that, again, is based on core ideas that themselves may be true, but the prescription for how to reach that is, of course, the poison which spoils the broth.
Well, James, I'd like to spend our last 10 minutes getting into solutions, and I would like to suggest I'd like to offer a solution, and then you can follow with yours and we can maybe take it in terms as time permits. But I guess the first thing I often think about with the whole system that we're faced with and what I've learnt over the years, and especially over the last couple of years doing this and sharing more information, obviously you research a lot more, but I guess there's two really fundamental things, but I'll take my first one first, and that is to become more self-sufficient in your own food supply. Food and water, I think, is a very important thing, and I think the less we rely on corporate interests to supply our food for us, and the more we can grow our food and ensure our water supply. That to me is one of the fundamental first steps in life, because our health is dependent upon what we actually put into our body. So I take an active interest in growing what food I can, and I encourage other people to do that, because you don't need a large space. You can grow food in pots or in very small places. I've seen huge amounts of food grown in small areas. And I guess for our listeners, James, I'd like to advocate that that is first step, one of the most important ones, to realizing self independence in our food, and less government controlled corporate food monopolies in my life.
This is such an important aspect of the entire, I think, what is the solution paradigm, which is all of a piece. And it all comes back to that fundamental idea of independence, self-sufficiency, which has been mixed in with some terms that obviously have their own political agenda that try to get us back into that collectivist mindset. And we can think about the sustainability and other kind of green ideas that come with a certain agenda that is almost the right idea, but it's got enough of the poison in it that it does spoil the entire mixture. And this goes back to at least three basic methods of control. And this was expressed perhaps best in a Henry Kissinger quotation, which in and of itself it may or may not be apocryphal. I haven't ever seen a valid source for this, direct source for this quotation. But at any rate, Kissinger has been attributed with the saying, "Who controls the food supply controls the people. Who controls the energy controls whole continents. Who controls money can control the world." And I think that's the three of the main things that we have to be concentrating on if we are to build up any kind of viable alternative. We have to look at the food supply, absolutely number one, because of course it is the thing that we need on a daily basis. Give us this day our daily bread, and we have to be responsible for that in some key sense. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we are 100% independent in that, but it at the very least should mean that we do know where our food is coming from, where it's sourcing from, and how that distribution, you know, channel is affecting us, so that if we're relying on the big agro-industrial complex to provide us our food, then we really don't know what we're eating. And people can at any rate look at things like the recent horse meat IKEA scandal as just another example of that, to remind us of why it is that we really don't know what we're eating when we're buying it from some nameless, faceless corporation in some chain supermarket in a store somewhere. And all of the convenience that system might afford us is more than made up for by the fact that all sorts of chemicals and other things that are being slipped into our products every day are drastically affecting the health of the population. And people only need to look at the obesity epidemic of recent years to understand that something fundamental is changing in our diets. And that, again, is ultimately, at the end of the day, our responsibility, because we choose what we put in our mouths. And if we sacrifice that convenience, or sacrifice the choice for the convenience of the agro-industrial system, then we are doing that at our detriment. And I guess the other two parts of that equation, the energy and the money, that can be more difficult, because it does require organization of some sort. I mean, just by their very nature, those are social constructs that do require some way of interacting with other people to create that. But again, it doesn't have to come down to governmental control. And I've been working, for example, on the subject of alternative currencies and complementary currencies lately, because I think that's another huge Achilles heel in the whole system of control. Because if we are in a system where we measure value in terms of the dollars or yen or pesos in our pocket, then again, we are under the control of the central banks that issue those currencies. But if we are involved in exchanges that rely on currencies that don't have anything to do with those central banks and aren't affected or controlled by those central banks, then in a key sense, we're off that grid. And as I say, again, it all comes back to that fundamental idea of independence and self-sufficiency, which is the real paradigm, I think, for measuring the value of the things that we're engaged in. How independent does this make me? Does this make me to the point where I rely on a system that is governed by a very few people, some nameless, faceless individuals at the tops of the big corporations who are in bed with the government, who rely on the bankers for their funding, etc.? Or does this make me a free individual who is able to survive whatever type of cataclysmic collapse may or may not be coming in the near future? And if the answer is that it does provide and afford that type of independence, then it must be for the good.
I'd like to lead on from that point regarding the economy and leave the thought with our listeners that the idea of open source and the idea that we present our work to everyone at no cost. Yet I think what I have practiced and what I want to practice in my life is that I want to support forms of media. I want to support suppliers into my life, whether it be via good food or whatever the products may be. That's where I want my economy to go. I want to support those people that are working to bless me in some way, encouraging the right thought process, and withdraw support from the corporate-controlled systems that exist, whether they be governments or media or television or radio or whatever they may be, that are constantly steering us into a direction through covert mind control, etc. But James, I believe in the open source concept that we should vote with our dollars and withdraw support with our economy from any other system that we do not agree with as far as possible in our lives. And in saying that, I want to thank you for the work that you've been doing over the years in encouraging these thoughts and indeed this conversation worldwide. I think your work is a credit. It is a leader in the non-corporate field. And I'd just like to give you the last 60 seconds, James, to tidy up and to direct listeners to your work.
Well, my work is at CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. And people can find links to all the other stuff that I'm doing from there. But let me just say that I want to concur wholeheartedly with you on the idea of open source. And I really do think that's the alternative paradigm that is being enabled by the types of technologies that are now at our fingertips for people to spread and share ideas completely for free and in a free manner all around the world instantaneously. And I think it's through creation of communities that are based on those types of voluntary, free, peaceful interactions and the spreading of knowledge that we'll be able to overcome all of the problems that exist in our system, not by any one person being the hero that saves the day, but by all the people collectively together sharing their knowledge. And I think that has to be the paradigm for a constructive future. So I'm 100% on board with that. And I hope that all the people out there who are interested in this can start looking into how they can apply this in their own life.
Well, great work. James, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate your time, and we wish you and your wife the best for your upcoming child very shortly.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.